This is Thinking in Public, a program dedicated to intelligent conversation about frontline theological and cultural issues with the people who are shaping them. I'm Albert Moeller, your host and president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Claire Morrell is director of the Technology and Human Flourishing Project, and she's also a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. That's a lead think tank there in the nation's capital. Prior to joining EPPC, Mrs. Morrell worked in the White House Counsel's Office and also at the Department of Justice. She received her bachelor's degree from Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Affairs, and her writing has been featured in outlets such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, National Affairs, and First Things. She frequently consults with legislators on technology policy and has helped draft legislation to protect children online. It is her new book, The Tech Exit, a practical guide for freeing kids and teens from smartphones, that is the topic of our conversation today. Claire Morrell, welcome to Thinking in Public.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Moeller.
I don't think many people these days would ask how timely a book like this might be. That we have an explosion of data coming in. I talk about much of this just week by week on the briefing and address them in other ways. I just did a podcast, a special edition podcast on the issue of sextortion and young men and boys. All of a sudden, I think there's the realization we're not looking at some kind of warning about some crisis in the future. The crisis is right here.
Yes, that's right. No, the crisis is definitely right now. And I think, unfortunately, parents have been sold this illusion, mainly by the tech companies, that if they just put parental controls and screen time limits in place on their children's devices or apps that they're using, then they will shield their children from all dangers or harms from those technologies. And the reality is that that is not working, that the underlying design of the technologies itself are dangerous to children, no matter what time limit is set, the way that they impact children's brains, the dopamine-inducing effects of these platforms make children constantly crave these things. And so what I've tried to explain to parents is we really have a metaphor problem. I think a lot of parents approach screens the way that they do sugar and say, okay, well, just a little bit in moderation. But that metaphor is not accurate. These technologies act on the brain more like a highly addictive drug, more like digital fentanyl. And so by their design, they can't be moderated. These things are harmful for children's development, particularly in these ages of their prime periods of development for their brain are being hijacked then by these technologies. And so there's both a design problem underlying the technologies. And then there's also the content, which I think, you know, you were alluding to with the sextortion schemes, the kinds of people that are reaching out to children through these technologies and the kinds of content they're coming across. And I think parents think parental controls will just kind of filter those things out or protect them from strangers. But even those fall far short of the problem, you know, so they're not, it is a crisis. And I just want parents to be aware that the solutions they think they're using are not delivering on their promise.
So I think that's one of the key issues in your book. And so I want to talk about the data. I want to look at that squarely. But one of the problems is that you really do have platforms taking advantage of this. So this isn't an accident. Their business model and the technology itself is built upon more and more eye time, more and more conscious time. And so parents can think they're somehow, you know, resolving this issue. And you're arguing that they're just fooling themselves.
Yes, precisely what you said. The tech companies, their business model is to sell data and time and attention to advertisers. And so they may advertise certain parental control settings, but they're meaningless because they're doing nothing to change that underlying business model, which is they want your child to spend as much of their time on the platform as possible. And so they may let you adjust some of the settings for privacy purposes, or set, as I said, some screen time limits. But the problem is that the physical time limits, or as you said, the eyeball, the eyeball time limits that a parent might set don't map on to a child's mental or emotional time, that they could be mentally consumed by what is happening on the app, even when their eyes are not on it, that they are thinking about who liked their post or what new followers they might have, because the metrics in the app are so designed to really capture our attention and create this craving for more. Because every time you get a new like or a new follower, your brain releases a neurotransmitter called dopamine, and that creates craving for more. And so there's never satisfaction. The child is always going to want more than the time limit. So it's an inherent problem in the design itself.
I have a great dislike for a lot of this, and I see around me, and I don't just mean among children and teenagers and young adults. I mean, I see around me too many fully grown people mm-hmm. whose highs and lows and yeses and nos are likes and dislikes are too much tied to social media. They can't tear themselves away from it. That's the frame of reference they fear, and that's where they get their excitement. That's something new in human history. It's not that there has never been an external threat to, say, a childhood or adolescence or to the family. I can remember the 20th century, the arrival of television was something of grave concern to a lot of Christians, as they were saying, look, you know, what's happening to our children's brains looking at too much television? And so in the 1970s, I can remember that there were warnings from medical authorities that, you know, children at too young an age spending too much time in front of a screen, that they're not showing up where they should be in reading, they're not showing up where they should be in conversation ability. That was the biggest thing in the 70s, was children with too much of that kind of screen time, they had a conversational deficit that, by the way, is very hard to make up. But now we're putting that not just in the living room, where parents actually could control it a lot. It wasn't like the kid could sneak around them while they're in the room. But now we're talking about an exponential explosion of that problem.
No, exactly. And I think often people want to just put this in the category of television and say, you're just being alarmist. We all thought this when TVs were coming out. And now look, most kids are fine. But it's so different because of just what you said. It's so highly individualized. And these devices now travel with children 24/7 in their pockets. And even by the nature of their size, they're very secretive. It's very difficult for a parent to actually see into what a child is seeing or doing on that screen. And there are not just one, you know, portal to the outside world. There's thousands within one device, because there are hundreds of apps. And within those apps, there are in-app browsers. And so you're really inviting the world and, you know, complete strangers into your work of parenting by handing a child a device. You don't even know what kind of influences they're taking in through that. And I would just also say on the point around dopamine, that this neurotransmitter really, it releases a burst of kind of pleasure in the brain to incentivize you to do that behavior again, but it doesn't produce satisfaction. And I think what's happening then, the threat to the family relationships are that children are turning to these devices, drawn to them compulsively, and it's severing the ties between parent and child when they're looking to the online world for their source of approval and satisfaction and pleasure. And it just constantly draws them back. And what they're being deprived of is oxytocin, which is the hormone that we get from interacting with other humans in real life, from eye contact and physical touch. That's what bonds parent and child. It's what bonds friends. And that is not something a child can get through a screen. And so not only are they becoming addicted to dopamine, but they're actually being deprived of the natural means that bond us with other humans.
Well, I didn't know we were going to dive so deeply into chemicals so quickly. But you know, we are having to learn a new vocabulary about a lot of this. And so I want to speak to you personally. Why did you decide to invest so much of your time and interest in this issue?
Thank you for asking. Yes, there's a whole story behind the book. The main way I came into this work was through public policy. I had served in the government, and then we had our first child, and I shifted to working for a think tank that would provide me more flexibility so I could be a full-time mother and write and research during my child's sleeping hours. And so that is how I started to then get into the work of looking at these threats to our children from digital technologies. What are public policy solutions to these problems? Because we've been talking about a lot of the individual effects, but there are collective aspects to these harms that a parent could do everything to protect their own child, but when another child can easily show them a smartphone, or the group dynamics that social media creates have collective effects. And the fact that these tech companies were coming between parent and child, a lot of these harms really necessitated public policy solutions. So I started working on laws to raise the age of social media by requiring parental consent. So state laws to say if you're going to form a contract with a child in our state to make a social media account, a parent needs to be part of that decision. And then also age verification for pornography websites. So my work was public policy focused, but I kept interacting with parents who were on the front lines. And they said, I can't wait for laws to be passed or for Congress and the federal government to raise the age of social media or address Section 230 reform. Like, what should I do? And my research had really convinced me I was never going to give these technologies to my children, but they were young, all under the age of 4 at the time. And so I decided I needed to talk to parents to see if there were parents who had successfully done this, successfully opted out, to find what advice I could offer to parents who are fighting these battles every day and feeling very dissatisfied with the current solutions they're being offered by the companies, but feeling helpless really to do differently. And so I wrote the book for those parents. The parents, I would say, are kind of stuck in this screen time trap where they know these things are bad. They've tried this solution of screen time limits and controls, and they realize they're not working out, but they need to be inspired with hope and courage and actually practical steps and examples for how to effectively delay these technologies completely out of childhood. And so that is how the book came about, was my policy work then led me into wanting to help parents who are really on the front lines in this fight.
Well, I appreciate that background. I think you've been at the Department of Justice, so you understand the policy world. And yet at the same time, as much as those policies are necessary, I don't think they're going to turn out to be adequate. The state of Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis, you know, very strong legislation, basically forbidding, children, I guess it's under age 14, from being involved in social media platforms. But I'm not sure how in the world they're policing that. You have Governor Youngkin, Glenn Youngkin there in Virginia. And just as we're speaking, the General Assembly has passed legislation he called for that will prohibit the presence of active cell phones by students during the school day. Okay, we'll see how that works. But, you know, I think it is interesting that states are taking pretty dramatic action. That's a good indication. Now, you work in the policy field. Policy lags behind the problem. And I think, you know, one of the points, you didn't make this explicitly in your book, but I want to give you that. I want to throw this at you now. It seems to me that given the development of the technology, the policy is lagging way too far behind the problem.
Yes. And that, I think, is inherent, as you kind of mentioned, in the policy process, is that especially in the United States, I think that we're not trying to overregulate technologies or other industries. And so we've often really left that kind of accountability structure to the courts process through litigation, that if a consumer then is harmed by a product, they bring a lawsuit. What's challenging with technology is we kind of have both problems, in the sense that it's difficult to predict where the development's going to go, to regulate these things ahead of time. We don't kind of want a European model of regulation. But at the same time, because of Section 230, which, just for listeners' awareness, is is the main law that governs the internet that basically said internet platforms cannot be held liable for harms from third-party content hosted by the platform. And so what that has done, it's been overexpanded by courts, has essentially immunized all of these tech companies for any of their own wrongdoing, even things that are their product design, like their algorithms or infinite scroll or autoplay or notifications. Any of these features have been kind of also, they've received immunity for those. And so the problem then has been these tech companies have been completely out of check. There's been no means to hold them accountable for the harms to consumers. And so that is why then, you know, legislation is necessary. But as you mentioned, it does always lag behind. I think though it's still necessary, we still want to make sure there is a way to protect children and ensure accountability in our system of justice like we would do for other industries.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, for parents, that's cold comfort. The lag there is cold comfort. Once our children are exposed to these things, they're exposed to them. Once the damage is done to our children, well, you know, it's good the law would be changed and policy would be put into place to prevent other children being damaged. But I can say, as an educator and as someone very active in Christian circles, I can just tell you, yeah, our young people are not immune from this, and the effects are long lasting.
Yes, no, and so that's why I wrote the book, right? I feel like I wanted to continue to do my policy work, but at the same time, you're right. Parents are the ones on the front lines, and these decisions are actually, they have long-term consequences. And I think parents understanding that it is actually stunting children's brain development in really critical ways. So I know we've been dipping into a lot of scientific terms, but just really the reality is it is stunting children's ability to develop comprehension and focus and attention, which they need to be successful in life. And on a most fundamental level, these technologies feed up endless and constant entertainment to children, and it undermines their ability to develop self-control. And I think any parent will realize that the most important thing that they are trying to teach their child is self-control, that it is the foundation or cornerstone of all other virtues or moral formation, that they need to learn to not act on all their impulses. And so I think that the screen by its nature, it sends a message regardless of the content on it. The medium is the message. And the message is that life is for entertainment. It's for you. It's for your own pleasure. It's not for loving God or loving others. It's not what this message the screen is sending. And that you can just be endlessly entertained. And that is the way then they cope. They turn kind of in any type of distress, it's just the screen, and they're not developing an ability to regulate their own emotions or exercise self-control. And so it is dire that parents need to do everything they can to protect childhood because it is critical. It's the foundation for their success and flourishing as adults.
I want to separate two issues here, and they're artificially separated, but for the course of our conversation here for a few minutes. So issue number one is the technology of the digital age with screens in hand. That's problem one. Problem two is social media on those platforms and the effects of social media. And so I think you inevitably kind of blend these things together. And in your research, you do a very good job of addressing both of those issues. But I want to, kind of, if we can, clinically separate them for just a bit. So let's talk about the problem of the technology of the screen, and then we'll turn to social media. What is the problem with the technology of the screen?
Yeah, so I think as I was saying, there's many problems, but I think on a fundamental level, it's detrimental for children's brains. The hyperactivity and the constant changing of entertainment really shortens children's attention spans, and it can actually overstimulate a child's developing nervous system. In fact, in some cases, doctors have said that they see children for symptoms of things like ADHD or autism. And when they do a screen detox and just completely take screens away, and we're not even talking about social media, just interactive tablets, video games, that the symptoms go away entirely, or in children who do actually have an underlying disorder, significantly reduced. And so that's to say that screens are actually mimicking and having the effects of certain psychological disorders just because they're overstimulating a child's developing nervous system.
I was in a restaurant with my wife the other day, And we see this often, but this was just an egregious case. We had parents at a table. This is a nice sit-down restaurant. And at the table next to us, parents with three young children. Every single one of them had a flat screen in front of them. The oldest one, I think, may have been first grade. The others younger. But they were absolutely each glued to a screen. There's no conversation in the entire meal. The mother and the father had conversation with the other, but it was like the children weren't there. It was like an Orwellian scene of dystopia in which these children are just being mind drugged so that they're nibbling on their snacks and leaving the parents alone. I mean, it's more sinister than just there's an attraction to it. There's something deeper going on here.
No, definitely. And I've tried to explain this, there's so many layers to the problem. And so getting down to even that next layer is the opportunity cost, like what isn't happening that should be happening right in a child's development because they're turning to a screen. And this kind of parenting by screen means a parent is not engaging them in conversation, is not forming those connections or even teaching them about the world around them. And it is training them to just expect entertainment, that there is no actually space for solitude or silence or contemplation, which is really important in just critical thinking skills. We have to be able to actually reflect. And so I think that the things that are being taken away by the screens are some of the most foundational aspects of what it means to flourish as a human being in the way that God created us and designed our minds and our bodies to work.
Yeah, there's something just very sad about childhood transferred to attention to a screen. Children, especially, say preschool children, they desperately need supervision, of course, but they need a lot of attention. They need a lot of eye contact. They need a lot of verbal experience. We know, for example, piles of research that the number of words a child hears in a human voice during the day has an incredible amount to do with how well they're going to do in school and thus in life and in vocation. And the imbalance is something a lot of people don't think about. You know, the imbalance is sometimes 4-1, in which case you have two parents in the home talking with a lot of FaceTime with their kids. Those children can receive, just in terms of words, 4 times more than a child in another circumstance. And that is a context that creates the right kind of cerebral activity and creates the right kind of deep relationships. And at the heart level, not only protects their hearts, but builds up their hearts. The screen is a net. It's a deprivation of those very things. I think most parents don't want to hear that kind of language.
They don't. And I think it's because, to be honest, I think another part of this problem, even with the language acquisition, which, as you mentioned, is such a key indicator then of their learning and their success later in life, is also the fact that parents themselves are addicted to their own screens. And so it's they're often handing a child a screen because they themselves are trying to respond to an email or a text message on a phone. And so it's a detriment in that the sense that parents are themselves, I think, often addicted to these technologies. Adults are certainly not immune to the addictive effects. They may be more powerful on a developing brain, but we are just as vulnerable to falling prey to the addictive design. And then these screens become an easy way to parent if they can just hand a child a screen so they can attend to what they're attending to on their own device. Yeah. But it's at the very expensive long-term cost to the child. And so I try to explain to parents, I'm not, blind to the fact that it takes a lot of parental involvement in those little years. The toddler years are incredibly intensive as a parent. And I can see why then it's so tempting for just a break to hand the child a screen. But you're creating bigger long-term costs to the child and to yourself. I think it's a lot more difficult than to deal with a screen-addicted child as an older tween and then teen. Whereas if you invest the time and energy into raising a child without a screen, giving them the skills that they need, capable of self-control, language learning, all these other things, they learn to entertain themselves. It becomes easier over the long term, and they have the ability then to be bored and to come up with things and have an imagination and creativity. And so that I want parents to understand, you want to pay the costs on the front end in investing in those little years so that you raise them to be flourishing humans and really capable of success as adults. And it will actually be for their long-term good. And it will be easier actually as a parent in the long run if you make those harder short-term investments.
Yeah, by the way, this is a footnote. So not, I don't mean to divert here, but I can't help saying that I find it very interesting when I hear young parents who talk about organizing the playtime of their kids. And then you find out the kids are school age. And you know that means there's a huge problem. To be a school age child is hopefully to have acquired the skills at organizing your playtime. You know,
that's
but,
right.
But they're not getting these skills. They don't have it. You know, it's like if a 10-year-old boy is asking his mom, "What should I do?" You know, his life's not interesting enough. Where are his friends? You know, what about the whole world outside?
Yeah. Yes. And I don't think we could say maybe screens are 100% responsible for that.
Absolutely.
But truly, if they're handed a screen, they're not developing the skills to do that for themselves. And then they do actually need a parent to step in and say, this is what you should do to play. So it's certainly a big part of that problem.
Yeah, this is another little footnote here. I was talking to a medical doctor about some of these things. And he said, you know, the amount of time a child stares open mouth at something, you know, just kind of in that catatonic almost state is taking away from vital developmental time. You know, if the child is in that state, nothing is developing. And you can't get back that time.
Yeah, no, exactly. And this is kind of similar to what you were saying about staring with their mouth wide open is I actually interviewed an ophthalmologist.
That's the way he put it, by the way.
Yeah,
It is a picture I think we immediately recognize.
Yes. Yeah. I interviewed an ophthalmologist for my book because I heard of her research on chronic dry eye in children. And so I called her to ask what she was seeing in her practice. And she said it was horrifying that these 8-year-old kids were coming in with chronic dry eye, which means their eyes were not sufficiently lubricated. And there were no other underlying autoimmune conditions that would lead to this. But the common denominator in all these patients was screen time. These kids were watching screens hours a day. And what happens is actually when a child's watching a screen, they're not blinking as often as they should be. And blinking is what really lubricates the eye. And so what she was saying is there's actually even a physical cost to the screen time in children, which is they're forgetting how to blink. And then a symptom that you would typically see in like an 80-year-old adult, we're seeing in 8-year-old children. And what happens is when those glands that lubricate the eye dry up by the lack of blinking, you don't get them back. And so these now 8-year-old children will be dealing with chronic dry eye the rest of their life. And if they're not attentive to it, it can lead to blindness. And that was a wake-up call to me that it's not even just these mental effects we're talking about, but it's physically degrading children's bodies to be staring at screens this much every day.
Well, I, the doctor was making the point with me that with the open mouth stare at the TV, there's a slowdown of respiration.
Interesting.
I think is correlated with this. It's just not good. But you know, that could have been true about television. It was. I think going back to the 60s and the 70s, 80s, I think people were concerned about that with television. And we kind of had prophetic warnings about the television as an alternative parent, you know, extremely inadequate to say the least. And when you did have the development of, say, the smartphone and digital media, flat screens, iPads, that sort of thing, it was the same, only different. There, because you have an infinite choice now. And it's, I realize mathematically it's not actually infinite, but for practical purposes,
close
it's
to
infinite.
It is.
Yeah, for practical purposes, it's infinite. But then you add social media. So this is the thing that I have to tell you. I've been involved in this space, as they say now, for so long, and I did not see this coming. Mm-hmm. And I even 5 or 6 years ago, I don't think we saw some of what now marks the danger of the social media environment so present. So go at that. You have a tremendous amount of very well analyzed research in this book on the particular dangers of social media to children and teenagers.
Yes. So I think, you know, we've all probably seen a lot of the headline research about the mental health effects in kids, that all of a sudden, around the time social media became really popular and increasingly addictive with certain metrics, like we're mentioning, like likes and other things, all of a sudden, the rates of anxiety, depression, self-harm admissions to hospitals for tween girls between ages 10 to 14, suicide rates among teens, we're talking about children attempting or committing suicide, skyrocketed. And the common denominator, and other researchers have really shown, it's not just a correlation, it is causation. They've ruled out other things that you could say would be behind this, mainly because it was worldwide across the developed world, not just the United States, but Europe, Australia, the UK as well. And so it really all correlated with the adoption of social media by tweens and teens. And it makes sense if you look at the way the platforms are set up. It is incentivizing children to hold themselves out to the world of their peers for judgment, for approval. And they're always tracking that. There are metrics attached to it. How many likes did your photo get? How many followers do you have? And this is in a time in a child's development, between the ages of 10 to 12, the dopamine receptors in a child's brain multiply and they become more oriented towards what we call social rewards, which is a normal process where children start to turn outwards from their family to develop other relationships in their community and with their friends. And at this exact period of time, teens were then getting on social media, and that process of development was being hijacked by the metrics and design behind these apps, which are often, I've explained this in my book too, it's not just a neutral social environment, it's one that's also inherently sexualized, that the more kind of illicit the content, the more likes or followers that you get. And so it also is incentivizing a certain
kind. The word
of
the cultural left is transgressive.
Interesting.
The more morally transgressive you are, first of all, the Marxist theory is the more progress you make in desensitizing society. But I think to make your point, that's exactly what happens, because you know people don't look at a boring picture.
That's right.
And like it. There's a reason why they're liking something. It is different. That's what makes it likable.
Yes. And as I've used the language before, that the platforms celebrate and promote vice. They habituate children towards vice, that this is normal. And they send that message by the kinds of content then that gets promoted. And I would also just say, like, social media has changed over time with the adoption of algorithms. It's actually no longer a place that's very social. It's not just connecting you to your friends that you live right in the same geographic vicinity right to, but actually complete strangers. We now have a whole category for these types of people. They're called influencers because they now have made their living.
It's a job.
It's a job to influence people.
By some estimations, more eighth and ninth graders say they want to be influencers as a job than traditional things like doctors, lawyers, and bakers. That's just gone.
Yes, I read a study that said it's like the number one career children say they would want to be when they grow up. Not an astronaut, not a fireman, a influencer. So I do think this is, and so that's also important to understand, is that it's now become really not, I don't think it's social media, it's recommendation media, because everything just gets recommended to you into your feed from complete strangers. So all this to say, I think the mental health harms that we're seeing, and just at the root of it, is really a loneliness. It's a social isolation, that the platforms that were supposed to help children be, quote unquote, more connected with their peers has left them lonelier and more isolated than ever, as they're comparing themselves to now, not just to their friends, to the universe. They're wanting these likes and these metrics, and that is how they then determine how they feel about themselves, is how they have performed on these platforms. So it's very, very detrimental to children's well-being and their development.
To get at the transgressive kind of nature of all of this,
I
have a new illustration of a photograph that went viral. And this one is not sexually suggestive, and that's actually going to turn out to be my point. Mm-hmm. The picture of the egg roll at the White House with the president and the first lady up on the balcony, along with the Easter bunny. And then the president, and I think someone in the White House needs to probably answer for this, the president was put in the position of offering an official statement about condolence and the death of the Pope. And he's giving a morally serious message. And there is this goofy looking bunny standing beside him. And that picture, just as you indicate right there, that picture went viral. And I used that yesterday to say, if you see a group of 15-year-old boys, somewhere in the hallway, and they're all looking at a phone, they're not looking at the president and the bunny.
Yeah.
They're looking at something else. You have no idea how transgressive this material is. And so I talk to dads, and especially in the context of Christian families, I talk to dads. And I'm shocked about how many dads, I think, get this and don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So I'm a father to grandfather. I can't speak of being a mother, but a mother thinking of a daughter or looking at girls in that. I think the vulnerabilities, as I want you to help explain, are different. But the transgression is the point. In other words, these social media platforms are only making money because of the spontaneous combustion of transgressive material.
No, that's exactly right. That's what their recommendation algorithms pick up. And that's what I was trying to explain. It really preys on our flesh and the kind of base desires that I think Christians are actively aware of and trying to resist. That is what social media is celebrating and promoting and preying on. And so unfortunately, it is communicating to children, then they start to think that this is normal, that the celebration of kind of vice on the platforms, whether that's sexual or violent, or as you just are saying, transgressive, something that is not humane, or it is not virtue forming, is what is celebrated. And so that is the kinds of content then they are incentivized to watch, they're incentivized to post. And I read this really sobering report that was in Forbes magazine, where this assistant dean of Harvard Law School was trying to explain what TikTok Live looked like, which was a live feature on the TikTok app. And she said, it looks like going down the street to a strip club filled with 15-year-olds, where girls were doing things on this platform in order to garner likes and tokens and things from complete strangers online. And so it is not a place I would allow my daughters to be or my sons. And I think you kind of were mentioning, for different reasons. I think that girls are incentivized to act sexually suggestive, and boys are incentivized to watch sexual material on these platforms. And so, and both are incredibly harmful to their well-being as a human, but also their moral formation, which I think should be paramount to parents in prioritizing.
Yeah, I want to shift to that in just a moment. I want to have some at least summarizing thoughts on the danger, particularly of social media. One of the key, this is something I'm writing now, so I'm kind of testing it out on you and others. One of the key issues of adulthood is being able to distinguish between public and private. And I think that's actually something that's, I mean, you know, you have little children and you have to tell them, we don't talk about that with strangers. You know, it's not appropriate to talk about that with this person. We have a public reality and a private reality. And it's not hypocrisy, it's wisdom to say that there's some things we only talk about inside the family. You can talk to me about that. You can't talk to just anyone about that. Social media exists to obliterate that distinction.
Completely.
And it may be even worse, Claire. It in some sense, it may actually say, no, don't talk to your parents about that.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
No. And I'm glad you brought this up, because I think I've tried to explain to parents that the social media platforms and these influencers come between parent and child. Instead of a child going to a parent with a question, they're going to go to social media and they're going to go to the internet instead. And they're not going to find the answers that you want them to know in those places. They're not, and their worldview is going to be shaped by complete strangers who are not you. And so when you hand this device to your child and you think that you can control it, there's an entire world of people out there who are actively trying to influence your child in ways that you would not want them to. And so that's why the answer in my book is that we need to completely opt out of these things. It is too difficult for a parent to oversee. And that parent-child relationship is the most important thing that needs to be protected, particularly because we recognize that there is parental authority The left would want to just erase that distinction. They would just say that children should be able to explore who they are, find whatever they want to online, that, you know, parents stand in the way of children truly finding who they are. And we don't ascribe to that. We would say a parent is the person in a child's life who is there, put in that position by God to protect that child and to raise them up to be an adult. And so there's a very particular job that we have as parents. And to do that job well, we need to completely remove these technologies because they are actively getting in the way of us doing our job in the way that we are called to do faithfully. And so, yeah, I would just say it is totally erasing the public and private, and children don't understand that distinction. And it's really a parent's job to protect them. And I'll just briefly say, I'm sure you're paying attention to the rise of these AI technologies. I think that the tech exit I'm arguing for has never been more urgent. The internet and social media platforms and smart devices are only going to become that much more dangerous when AI is integrated with all these things, because the AI is going to even more blur the difference between reality and fantasy. And it will be very difficult for a child to discern that and to discern what's true. And so
you
I think
have
it's
the mainstream
paramount.
Media. Claire, talking about the problem of women in particular developing relationships with bots.
Oh, yes, and, the chatbots. You know,
yeah, and one of the most, and personality chatbots, their ongoing personalities. Mm-hmm. And there was, in one of our most prestigious magazines, there was an extensive article about a young woman who was in love with one of these bots, and she knows it's a bot. Mm-hmm. Posing as a young man, And she knows it's a bot, and it expires every 30 days, and
she
has to begin it all over again, and does it. So I mean, the seductiveness of this, and you know what's so sad is not just the absence; it's the presence. It's mm-hmm. not just the fact that this is a dangerous thing. It's also entrapping an awful lot of people who aren't actually talking to fellow human beings, in which what they really yearn for could possibly happen.
Yes, exactly. And I'm actually worried from a societal and civilizational standpoint. What does this mean if then people are not incentivized to form relationships in real life? What that does then to the formation of marriages and to families, that if people are replacing real life people with chatbots or just with social media or pornography, that is going to decrease our marriage rates and the formation of families.
And we're
seeing that. And, you know, Japan is horrifying on this. And and I think you would see the kind of rise of some of these technologies, young men just video gaming and watching pornography in their parents' basements and not getting married. Exactly. And I don't think that we are as far off as we think from that, even in the United States.
No, let me give you some evidence. I appreciate how much evidence you analyze and bring forward in your book. Here's another bit of evidence. And this is something that Christians are having to think about pretty carefully, because let me give you good news. Good news. The out of wedlock birth rate in the United States has gone down precipitously. Teenage pregnancies have gone off a cliff in terms of going down. It's not just down. I mean, they are way down. Good news, right? Okay, the bad news is some of that is due to chemical abortion. Mm-hmm. But the other issue is a lot of these pregnancies are never happening because there is simply no dating. There is absolutely no risk. And you look at that, you go, well, wait just a minute. Our expectation that young people will grow into relationships, that will grow into marriage, that's not being completely derailed. We've got 18, 19-year-old young men who don't have a clue how to talk to an actual physical young woman of the same age, and vice versa.
No, exactly. And that's the most pernicious aspect of these technologies, is it's easier for people to just go get their hit of pleasure through the screen than to do the work of building a relationship in real life. And so we're taking these cheap digital substitutes instead of the real thing. And it's going to have really detrimental effects on an individual level, but also on a societal level. And so that is why, you know, in my book, I really tell parents we have to push these things out of childhood, because then we at least give them a chance of being able to have a moderate, healthy use of technology as they may have to interact with it in their workplace as adults. But if we can protect childhood and the formation of their habits, that will go a long way towards that.
So let me tell you what I fear, Claire. I'll tell you what I fear. What I fear is that an awful lot of intelligent, certainly well-intended Christian parents, an awful lot are going to hear and say, well, I'm kind of with you on the problem, and I want to do everything to mitigate the problem, but what you're suggesting is just way too radical. I mean, what could childhood be in the 21st century without a smartphone? How, I'm putting this off, not letting him have it at seven. I'm not letting him have it till he's 14, which, by the way, when you, I used a teenage boy as an example here. If you think that is increased maturity on some of these big issues, you're fooling yourself. But you know what I mean? It is an imperative. Yeah. And you address that in the book. You're calling for a clean break, and you offer not only argument and evidence, but even, you know, practical suggestions. But I think an awful lot of parents are going to say, I'm with you until that point, and then they're just going to tune you out.
Well, I hope that they don't. And I really tried to write the book addressing that group of parents. The parents that I would kind of say are in the moderate camp, which is, I know these things are bad. I agree on the problem. I don't know how to kind of totally opt out. I want to give this to my child with, you know, moderation. And so I tried to write it in such a way to both convey it is actually possible to opt out of these things. It's not as impossible as it seems. This is how other families have done this. It's also what is best for your child. And it's never too late to do the right thing. I think a lot of parents feel like, I've already given this to my child, and it would just be way too hard to take it away. And I try to actually offer examples and even walk parents through how to do a digital detox, that it's never too late to reverse course. When you realize as a parent, this is something harmful to my child, it's not what I thought it would be, that you can actually back out and reverse course and take something away. And so I try to address, I think, the issue that you're raising, which is parents would just think this is just too difficult to do, by walking them through how other parents have done this. And I as a parent personally find examples incredibly helpful and powerful to know that there are other people who have done this. This is how they've done this successfully. And so the book walks through how to detox from these things, and then actually gives parents a path forward, how to do this over the long term, using an acronym, FEAST, that we go from fasting on screens to feasting on the real world by finding other families. I think it's critical that you have a community around you so that your children do have friends who have the same tech-free lifestyle and are actually able to then play with your child in real life, and that you as a parent have allies, that you're not doing this alone. And I think churches, neighborhoods, schools are great natural venues to find those communities. And then you have to educate and explain your reasons to your child. I think if you particularly want to train them to then know how to use and operate technology wisely as an adult, we need to explain these things to our children, educate them on the harms and explain our rationale, and exemplify for them a healthy use of technology. So I just pushing back on the kind of myth of, well, if I don't give it to them, then they're just going to binge on technology when they leave my home when they're 18. I think it's a complete myth. I've interviewed grown children who did not grow up on technology, and they would actually tell you, even when I got a smartphone in college, I was a lot more prepared for how to use it wisely because I could recognize when I was using it too much, that they had this kind of tether to what a life without it looked like as a kind of red line then when they were doing it too much. But that actually how parents train children to operate things that are really only for adults, like cars or other technologies that we restrict to adulthood, is they exemplify healthy use. And so I think that's the most important thing that a parent can do, is just model it for their own child. And then just briefly, A is adopting alternatives. There are other means of staying in touch with a child than a smartphone, phones that don't have access to the internet or social media. And then setting up digital accountability and family screen rules, that you may decide to have a TV in the home, that you enjoy a family movie night together, or you have a home computer for them to conduct research, maybe especially as they're in high school, but that your screen use is always public and purposeful, that there's accountability between family members, and that if you're using it for entertainment, you know, that's sparing and it's shared together. And then the last thing is, well, what do I do with my child's time instead? I think parents feel kind of helpless of what they'll do if they take the screens away. And so the last principle of the book is that we trade the screens for real life responsibilities and pursuits, and that actually children really enjoy having the independence of engaging in real life responsibilities and tasks in the household. And so while we restrict their freedoms in the digital world, we can slowly allow them greater freedoms in the real world to develop those kind of markers towards adulthood. And so that's the message of the book.
The family context here is so important. Let me offer you two avenues of evidence. One is the young Christian families that I see really thriving. The kids do not have access to screens. And, you know, they're just constantly engaging each other all the time, which is, I think, the quintessence of childhood. That's what it is. You know, brothers and sisters, siblings and friends, you know, on a playground, they're just doing what God made kids to do. Mm-hmm. And they're not, they don't consider that time away from the screen because they don't have a screen to go back to. And so it just, it's very healthy. The other thing I wanted to point out is that I find a lot of people asking me, okay, so you've got seminary students in their, you know, 20s and 30s. You've got undergraduates at Boys College, you know, 18 to 22 years old. What do they look like? I want to tell you something I've never really said out loud before. There's a pattern we see. And that pattern is that students come in using screens more. And by the midpoint of the first semester, they're using them much less. And it is because, here's the good news, they will trade the screen for socialization when they have the opportunity. They'll discover greater joy and fulfillment in the socialization. They can learn how to exercise self-control. And they are in a context in which, you know, frankly, the college campus is sometimes referred to as hyper-socialized. Well, it is on healthy campuses. It's not on other campuses. So I just want to offer that. In other words, a word of hope. You know, I see young families who are actually doing this. And I also see, you know, late teenagers, early adults who are demonstrating the fact that they've kind of figured out they don't want to live an online life.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I'm so glad you ended too with that like positive point, because I even talk about that in the book. You may have neighbors on your street who are not on the same page as you, particularly about all the screen restrictions, but you can even just by focusing on the positive of getting your kids playing outside together, when they actually taste that real life good, the cheap substitute of the screen is so much less appealing. And so you can do even small things. Focusing on the positive will then by necessity mean less time on the screens. And so you can even have that community with people who are not on the 100% same page about screen restrictions. And so getting your kids just playing outside is like the first step, I think, towards trying to pursue a real life of flourishing away from screens.
Yeah. A final word of warning, though. I don't think it's possible to exaggerate the dangers of the screen exposure and social media vulnerability to kids. That's one of the reasons why I did a special edition of the briefing for the problem of teenage boys and young men on the sextortion.
Yes.
And you know, Claire, what's new there, and is kind of one of the reasons why I decided to go ahead and do that special edition. What's new there is that when this began, it began with boys and young men kind of going to places they shouldn't have gone. That still happens, of course, but now it is the dark side coming to them through gaming chats, through sports chats, you know, going off of fan bulletin boards and sports chats, in which and you know, these there are entire, you know, centers, as you know, in other parts of the world, and in particular in impoverished countries, where there are people basically doing nothing but running these scams against American children and teenagers.
Yes. No, exactly. It is, I think it's important to understand that the nature of the technology has allowed really bad actors, predators, very easy access to children that they never would have had. As you mentioned, people from all over the world. And so, Yes, kids aren't even looking for this. These are people just showing up in their messages who are not even in the same geographic location, but portray themselves to be a 15-year-old girl down the street. And so it's incredibly dangerous.
Absolutely. But that's where things are different now. It's not just, for instance, that someone posing as a girl who's actually a middle-aged man, in some distant country. Soon you're going to have machine intelligence emulating this, and that will be even more insidious.
No, exactly. They'll be able to do it at such a greater scale. And I think, there was a recent report that Snapchat basically didn't deny that they get over 10,000 reports a month of sextortion schemes. And that's just one platform. And so just imagining the scale that will now be at once you easily have AI to do this for you, for predators, is just scary to imagine.
Another thing when it comes to the vulnerability of girls and young women, my wife, often remarks on this herself, you have 13, 14, 15-year-old girls who are dressing like rather promiscuous college students, this is where they're getting all the signals. It's a sexualization that's just insidious, and I my heart breaks thinking of what's going to be lost.
Yes. No, it's become very normalized. And I think that's the problem, is when their social world is social media, they think that is normal. And what I've tried to convey is that through social media, we are really seeing the sexualization of childhood, that children are being taught that the most important thing about them is their sexual desires or impulses. That's obviously extremely damaging. It's both on an individual level, but also as a society, is frightening.
So I do want to commend your book, The Tech Exit. I want to go a little bit further in this. I want to dare Christian parents to read it. Because there are a lot of Christian parents who are going to think, this isn't my problem, it's not my kids. I just want to dare you as a Christian parent to read this book, or a Christian leader in particular. Anyone concerned with young people. Read this book and come face to face with the evidence, and you'll understand the moral responsibility that falls on us like no previous generation.
Thank you so much. Yes, absolutely. I would really say that I think your minds might be changed if you read the book, that it is both imperative and necessary to opt out, and it is possible and fundamentally positive, that saying no to screens is saying yes to a enriching life for your childhood that will lead to their long-term success and flourishing and happiness as an adult. And the time is now. Yeah. It is urgent.
Well, Claire Morrell, thank you so much for joining me today for Thinking in Public.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Moeller.
Many thanks to my guest, Claire Morrell, for thinking with me today. If you enjoyed today's episode of Thinking in Public, you will find more than 200 of these conversations at albertmoeller.com under the tab Thinking in Public. For more information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. Thank you for joining me for Thinking in Public. And until next time, keep thinking.